Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
That was from Sean Spicer. He's United We Stand's official harmonica player. And we have talented writers for United We Stand, but we have talented musicians as well. You can see the link below to follow Sean's stuff. So, this podcast, well, we've got a really good guest coming up in Enjoy Dursum. And just before that, I'm going to play a little bit of the interview that I did with Omar Barada a couple of weeks ago at Old Trafford. It's his first sit down face to face on the record interview since he took the Manchester United job 11 months ago. And I went in there worried. I'm worried because of what I saw last season with United, of what I saw in Bilbao. I said I've never felt lower as a United fan. And that is true. I was too young to remember the relegation period. And I came out of that interview feeling more optimistic. He's clearly sharp, he's clearly smart, clearly very good at his job, but it's also difficult. It's difficult working at Manchester United with the structure around the club. And we've seen some of the best managers in the world come to United and leave after 2.5 years because things have not worked out. But I think most United fans would wish Barada well in trying to turn around the club's fortunes. And he explains himself in great detail. The interview in United We Stand is huge. And as I said, it was 70 minutes. So what you're only going to hear now is like 1 minute of it. So what we appreciate and need is for you to buy the mag, support the mag, because interviews like that take a huge amount of effort and money and time, and you can really read it easily. Just a couple of clicks and you can download it and read on your tablet or on your phone, or you can order a single issue or a subscription. We did the first mail out on the 10th of June and people received their copies really quickly. Well done, Royal Mail. And the second mail out will be on the 20th of June. We've had to put the prices up of postage because we don't benefit by mass bulk prices for that one. So it was a bit more expensive, but Ant's going to be sending them out and he does a good job of that. Just PayPal, United We Stand. UWSmag at yahoo.co.uk with your name and address. It's £6.95 for UK, £7.95 for Europe, and £8.95 for the rest of the world. I'm sorry about them prices. It's nothing we can do about the one-off mail costs. And if you'd met the deadline, they would have been significantly cheaper than that. So I've got 6 weeks now without going to a football game. My last game was in Munich for the Nations League last week. That's about my 85th game of the season. I saw a lot of Manchester United defeats last season. And the Nations League, I saw some brilliant football. Unfortunately, and the final, I sat in the press area because I was working, and I heard a big bang and felt my desk moved, and that was because a fan fell from Neil Pitea and died. He fell 8 metres, hit a desk on the way down, and went even further down into a stairwell onto a concrete floor. And he was a 35-year-old Romanian who lived in Munich, and I don't think anyone knows him, will be listening to this, but my condolences are to him and his family for what happened there in Munich. So here's Omar, and then we're going to go straight into our guest. I'll do another podcast in a few weeks, just need a little bit of time off, to be honest, and time with my family. And then we will be pre-season in the United States. I'll try and take some fanzines out there as well. Do a couple of events maybe out there, and the season starts again. Got the fixtures coming out this week. Here we go again. What close season, eh? Anyway, here's a little bit of Omar.
The best example is Cunha. So top player that could have gone anywhere, really.
So why did he come to United?
Because he's convinced by what we're trying to do.
Yeah,
he's convinced by what were, you know, our ambition, but by, you know, Ruben as a coach, Jason's vision for the squad, our ownership and the management team, you know, idea for how we're gonna grow and stabilize the club. So Cunha just brings it to life, and there are other players that feel exactly the same way. And that's exactly what we want. We want players that want to join United because they believe in the club, not because we're in the Champions League 1 year or not. And that's really important for us. So on players, I don't think we'll find it more difficult. And actually, the ones that don't want to come here because we're not in the Champions League, we probably don't want.
Our guest now is Joey Durso. He's a journalist, a very good journalist. He used to be at The Athletic, and now he's working for The Times. I've worked with him on several projects before, and it's someone who I greatly admire. And he's written a book called More Than a Shirt, How Football Shirts Explain Global Politics, Money and Power, which is published by Orion, and it's out now. Welcome to the United We Stand podcast, Joey.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about your book. And this is a global book. Did Manchester United come into your research, into your travels when you were doing this?
Many times. I mean, so the basic idea is that football shirts explain the world, and I've been all over the world, been to 5 continents to tell that story. So you know, you can obviously look at the Middle East, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. That's a story that you could tell through the shirts of Barcelona, from Newcastle, Gazprom, Schalke in Germany. You know, that Putin's invasion of Ukraine. You can understand that story through the way that Gazprom, the Russian gas company, sponsored big club there, Schalke. You know, German politicians will be schmoozing with Gazprom executives in the box at Schalke, who famously, their biggest moment was the Champions League semi-final of 2010-11 when they lost to Manchester United. That was their sort of high point, with Raul, and they had Raul and whatever else. But yeah, Manchester United came up a lot. I mean, everywhere I went, I recall being in a cab in Cape Town, and my driver was a Zimbabwean bloke. There's a lot of Zimbabweans across the border in South Africa recently. We got chatting. I said, "Are you working football?" And he said, "I'll support Manchester United." And I'll be honest, my instinct is a bit, "Oh, here we go." You know, is he going to say, "Oh, does Wayne Rooney still play for them?" Or, you know, and he's like, "What do you think of Ruben Amorim's press conference at the weekend and what he said about, you know, Diogo Dalot's injury?" And I was like, "I'm sorry, mate, you know more than me here." Like, the level of, which sounds an almost kind of, I don't know, patronising thing to say, but as a Brit, as a British fan of an English club, you sometimes think, oh, these fans around the world are maybe a bit, are they really that into it? And the level of obsession you see with Manchester United. I watched it was an FA Cup game against Fulham. I think Fulham were doing quite well, and then there was like a dodgy red card. Did a Fulham player last? That was about 2 years ago. I watched that with the Mumbai Manchester United Supporters Club, and this was about midnight on a Sunday their time. And these guys were Manchester United obsessed. What really struck me about that, actually, which is something I come back to a lot, is that, again, you sometimes think these fans support Manchester United or whoever else like it's Disney or, you know, some fake plan. But they're so obsessed with it, not just on the football level, but the idea of it being a sort of authentic Northern English city. You know, they don't want to be the plastics. They really care about... the other thing that really struck me is, you know, I'm 33, so my childhood was like peak Sir Alex Ferguson. To me, you know, just the best team when I was a kid. These guys were mainly a bit older than me. But they were talking about Manchester City in particular. They've got mates who are glory hunters. Maybe their little brothers are City fans. And they're like, "We're the real fans." In the same way, if you met like an Oldham fan or a Wigan fan, they might look, "Oh, right, Man United, yeah, I'm a real fan." That was the way that they saw themselves as being Man United fans, was being not the glory hunters, but being the proper football fans who support the team that, frankly, is not doing very well at the moment.
Fascinating. So you say Schalke, they played Manchester United in the 2011 Champions League semi-final. I know one of their directors, or he's moved on now, and a couple of senior people in their club who, on the quiet, are Manchester United supporters. So that was quite interesting for me to hear that from you. These are people who, you know, get in touch with me and ask me the same type of questions that you were asked when you're in that the taxi in Africa. And we'd worked together, hadn't we, at The Athletic on a story coming out of Africa about fabricated stories about Manchester United. And just tell us what happened there when we started doing the research.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. I mean, someone pointed out to me these Facebook pages with a lot of views that have, frankly, ridiculous... I think it was Erling Haaland, sort of 2 years after bagging 30 goals a season for Man City. There's a picture of him in a sort of AI-generated Man United shirt saying, or Kylian Mbappe, whatever, you know, this is happening. If you know anything about football vaguely, you know that that's ridiculous. But, you know, maybe people don't know that. And people are just... I think what people do in some parts of the world, that's quite hard to get your head around if you... maybe live in the UK, is people use Google rather than Twitter or Facebook or whatever to get their news. So they wake up and they type into Google Manchester United, and hopefully we'll get a reliable link from you on The Athletic or wherever else. But if you're clever, you can write a fake link about Kylian Mbappe being about to join, get to the top of the Google results, and then if you pay for Google adverts on that link, you can then make money. So this guy, I rang him up, a guy in Nigeria, he was a student, and he was making a load of money doing this. You know, not a lot, I can't remember the exact figures, but certainly a
£2,000 a month.
£2,000 a month, yeah, I mean, that's a decent salary, especially in Nigeria, where things are cheaper than they are here. So he's either a fake news merchant who's besmirching our good industry, or an entrepreneurial young man, whichever way you want to look at it.
You're a Villa fan, but you've been to Old Trafford as a Villa fan.
Yeah, several times. Well, a couple of times. The last time I was there was the League Cup. It was a 4-2, I think. Frustrating. We had a reserve goalkeeper, Robin Olsen, who's not very good, and I think that didn't help. But it was 4-2. I think it was Villa were leading at one point, and then United won about 2 or 3 years ago. But yeah, I like Old Trafford. You know, I mean, we've had this discussion before. I get it. If there's rain falling on your head, it's probably not much fun. But I think there's a charm to it that maybe some of the newer stadiums don't have. And, you know, I think the new owners have got to be careful when they move to, you know, retain that. It's a bit spit and sawdust. The £3 beers really struck me, which is absurdly cheap these days for the UK. I mean, I've drank beers in dozens of grounds in England, and that's half the price of what you might be paying in the, you know, National League or in non-league football. So it's pretty remarkable. I mean, you tell me, what are the reasons for that? Is it that the Glazers are getting all sorts of flack from all sorts of other things and they think, you know, this is one thing where we can maybe keep the fans on side? I don't know.
Yeah, they did a lot of small wins in the sort of COVID and post-COVID era where they tried to keep the match-going fans on side by doing things like making beer prices cheaper. But I think they realised whatever they do, people are going to moan anyway, because the Glazer ownership model is not a good one for football. But people will just moan anyway, even if they were like 10 pence for a beer. They just... Yeah. But I do think a lot of people actually appreciated the fact that beers were far cheaper in a stadium, which is rare, than in a pub. So on your book, you've travelled the world. Which stories stuck out to you? Because when you mix in geopolitics with football, I'm thinking of China, I'm thinking of Saudi Arabia, American ownership in the Premier League, connections, as you say, to, you know, Russia with Schalke and Red Star, as you've touched on.
Yeah, so China's an interesting one. It's one of the few places I didn't go, for pretty obvious reasons. It's not really a place to go asking too many questions these days if you're a journalist. But the shirts I used to tell that story were West Brom. So West Bromwich Albion were owned by an absentee Chinese owner from about 2016 to 2024. They sold that recently to an American guy. But Guangzhou Evergrande, with this huge superpower of Chinese football, and they had Fabio Cannavaro was their manager. They had Paulinho from Tottenham and Barcelona. They had Oscar from Chelsea, some really big players. But what I've tried to do with each part of the book is not just tell a story of a bigger global topic and how football sort of tells it. So that I've called it China's Rise and Retreat. So China went from being a sort of second, third tier nation, you know, very agricultural, very poor, to being, particularly in the 2000s, booming and becoming the second biggest economy in the world. So much of what we, you know, these laptops and phones and microphones that we're talking on now are all made in China. Real urbanisation, people flooding from the countryside to the cities, and football. So it's pretty much solely Xi Jinping, the leader, is obsessed with football. Watford, under Graham Taylor, toured China in the 80s, and Xi Jinping went to it and was apparently disgusted about how bad, you know, the Chinese national team got battered by Watford, who no one in China had ever heard of. And he sort of saw it as his passion project of his to make China better at football. So in the early 2010s, they poured money into it. And, you know, a bit earlier than that, you have players like Li Tai at Everton and Sun Jihai at Man City. But it basically didn't work. They didn't get any better, certainly not the national team. And I saw that in India as well. It's quite an interesting thing. You know, these countries with a billion or more people, why are their national teams so bad? And then you've got, you know, the Netherlands with 10 million or Portugal. And basically the reason is, if you're not in a top academy at the age of 7 or 8, you're never going to be as good as a Premier League player. So unless you have that infrastructure and families are into it, and from a really young age, it doesn't matter how much you pour into elite football. But basically, they got bored or they got embarrassed. And it all changed around the time of COVID. China sort of retreated from the world more broadly. It had really onerous COVID restrictions. You couldn't get in or out of there for 2 or 3 years. And they kind of pulled back from football. And English football tells a story of that. You had teams like, well, Aston Villa, Birmingham City, West Bromwich Albion, Southampton, who were all under Chinese ownership, that have now, I mean, many of them become American now. I mean, you mentioned that American money is the big one now in English football. And lots of the other sources of wealth are pretty much drying up. And I interviewed a dissident, basically, someone who used to work in Chinese football, who said, Li Tai, who's a former Everton player, managed the national team, has now been imprisoned for corruption. And it's all really shady. No one quite knows what's going on in China. But I think, you know, these football shirts are a way to tell that story. The Guangzhou Evergrande property company that was all over that shirt is now gone kaput.
West Brom also visited China in the late 1970s. That was when their players were offered a trip to see the Great Wall of China, and one of them came out with the famous line, "No, you've seen one wall, you've seen them all."
Correct.
Sun Jihai played for Manchester City. I was speaking about him to Andy Cole quite recently, and he really rated him as a player. Said he was absolutely top player. Clearly, you know, not Ronaldo-level player, but it surprised me how well he was rated. India, so I had a really mad situation the other day where two of my friends managed against each other in a match. Manolo Marquez is the coach of India, against Ashley Westwood from Manchester, who's the coach of Hong Kong, in a really important game. Both of them called me beforehand just to sort of feel out because, you know, and both of them said in the pre-match press conference, yeah, we have a mutual friend here. And I was very diplomatic between the two of them. And Hong Kong beat India.
Yeah, I mean,
India's 1.2 billion people, 1.3 billion people.
Yeah.
And Hong Kong, which is tiny, beat India. Cha-ching, when you start a new business, there's a lot to go in on. And it can feel pretty overwhelming. And every day you've got a new decision that needs an answer, whether you're starting off with something new. It just seems that your to-do list keeps growing every day with new tasks and it can easily begin to overrun your life. Finding the right tool that not only helps out but simplifies everything can be a game changer. And for millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify with its cha-ching sound. Shopify is a commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started. You can get started with your own design studio, with hundreds of ready-to-use templates, and Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store to match your brand style. Accelerate your content creation. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. Get the word out there like you've got a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And best yet, Shopify is your e-commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping and processing returns and beyond. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. Turn your big business into a cha-ching with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your £1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.co.uk/united. Go to shopify.co.uk/united. shopify.co.uk/united.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting topic that. And I went to Reliance, which is one of the big companies running one of the IPL cricket teams in Mumbai, and I interviewed some people there. And I think what's interesting is the World Cup expansion to 48 teams, which is more Asian teams and African teams than Europe. I think Europe's only getting about three more teams. But if you're the Indian FA qualifying for the World Cup, you know, not next year, but in 10 or 20 years' time, suddenly feels much more realistic than it did when there were 32 teams. So I think that's why I'm kind of in favour of this expansion, because I think in a country like India, it all feels a bit, you know, they could reach that top table more than they might be able to before. But yeah, unless you have kids in an academy when they're seven, they're never going to be as good as League One footballers, let alone Premier League footballers.
How big a part does the Premier League play in football's globalisation? Because it's the biggest league, does that make it hugely attractive? You know, Man United's leading executive basically left from Barcelona to move to Manchester first with City because he felt the Premier League was far more important, which is some statement. And yeah, we can see that it's attracting people from all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, Barcelona, I've got the shirt.
Yeah, I don't really want to see that. Reminds me of
I didn't even think of that. God, it's a Barcelona UNICEF shirt. Bad memories. But anyway, that was obviously a very nice charitable gesture around the 2010 era for possibly the greatest club team of all time. They've been that all off recently because they need the money. First from Qatar, the foundation and the airways, and more recently Spotify. So Barcelona has obviously been this, you know, Mesquian club, seeing itself as above the money grabbing of other teams. You know, now they're just a sort of coldly corporate organisation like the rest of them. The interesting thing about that Barcelona Real Madrid versus the Premier League is La Liga really doubled down on two clubs, almost two players, right? Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi. Undoubtedly the best two players in the world, better than anyone in the Premier League at the time. But the club brands have suffered, and, you know, below Barcelona and Real Madrid, they are not global brands at all, whereas the Premier League is a product. It really struck me in Cape Town. I spoke to that massive Man United fan. Man United fans everywhere, lots of them mentioning Quinton Fortune. It was actually United-Liverpool. I think it was a 2-2 draw on the day I was there. It was in January. So there were shirts of the two teams everywhere. But I was walking through this shopping centre. There's a big screen up. And I was like, oh, it's some sport. I wonder what it is. And it was Southampton against Brentford, which is hardly, you know, box office. But in this huge shopping centre was just people watching it. People were interested in it.
And yeah, I went to Cape Town with Quinton Fortune in 2000, into the Cape Flats. and he wasn't recognised that much. And people had Michael Owen shirts on. So maybe even since then, because there was no real internet about then, if I would imagine if you were Quinton Fortune now, everyone in Cape Town would know who you are if you'd signed for Man United, because you've got so much access to information.
Yeah, and I think that's another thing, that the scale of high-speed internet and Starlink, which is really, really cheap, and there are people who might not be able to heat their own houses, might be living in pretty primitive, impoverished conditions in South Africa and India and wherever else. But I think Premier League, I mean, I'm sure your listeners will know this, but Premier League matches in India, I think an annual subscription is £20 or £30, which even for people who are pretty poor can pay that. So, yeah, there are people who are streaming the latest Manchester United games who might be living in real poverty, which wouldn't have been the case 10 or 20 years ago.
I was approached a couple of years ago by Fulham's main sponsor, whose raison d'etre was installing internet in rural Africa, which was anchored to balloons. This was his vision.
I vaguely remember this, yeah.
I was like, whoa, this is way too ahead of my line of thinking. Why on earth do you want to meet me? Where can this conversation go? But the globalness of the Premier League has attracted nation states, sports washing.
Yeah, big topic in the book. Yeah, of course, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Abu Dhabi.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? We just assume it's a bad thing.
I think it is a bad thing. States basically have... I mean, one thing I try to do in the book, by the way, is be pretty optimistic and positive. Like, I always think, no one's forcing me to go to football and write about football, and I could be doing something else with my time, and I don't just want to be a moaner. And I love it, and I think it's great, and I love the current Premier League, flawed though it is. But yeah, I think states owning clubs is bad. I mean, because they've got literally bottomless pockets, right? Or certainly bottomless when it comes to football. And then what that does is it drives up fees and wages for everyone else, and then you get this sort of inflationary spiral where players are getting paid £200,000-£300,000 a week, and a lot of that money is going to come from fans through the form of tickets or through the form of TV subscriptions, which keep going up and up. If Newcastle, obviously the FFP, PSR rules and the financial rules in the Premier League now, which I personally think are a good thing, change that a bit, because Newcastle can't just go and pay someone £500,000 a week. I think it's bad for that reason. It creates this inflationary spiral.
And yet you just said you didn't think the current model of the Premier League is a good one. Why?
I said I'm pretty in favour of the financial rules.
But not the financial rules.
Oh, the state ownership, absolutely, yeah.
No, not the state ownership. You said you like the Premier League, but as if it was somehow flawed.
Yeah, I think there are a few current flaws. I think the big one at the moment is the relegated and promoted teams are really getting cut adrift. I think you've seen an equalisation, which might not be to you or your audience's pleasure, between the biggest teams and the middle. I think that gap has shrunk quite a lot, mainly because the middle teams can afford really good players. The likes of Wolves or West Ham or Villa are packed with far better players than they were 10 or 15 years ago. So the gap between Manchester United or whoever is smaller. The gap between the middle and the bottom is growing. I was chatting to a Leeds fan the other day, and they're going to get promoted, and they're only allowed to spend £100 million, and they'll very likely go back down, despite they're a big club, they've got a big fan base, much more so than Bournemouth or Brentford or whoever else. Not that they've got any more right to be there because of that, but the gap is just, and I worry that we'll be in a situation in 3 or 4 years where that 17 is just going to become completely locked in. And each year, I was chatting to this Leeds fan who was saying, oh, Bournemouth, they're a bit tin pot. They've got a tiny stadium, Surely they'll have a bad season. And it's like, well, Bournemouth have been in the Premier League for, I think, 8 out of the last 10 seasons. You get £100 million a year for that, plus all sorts of extra sponsors. They've basically banked £1 billion, little Bournemouth. A lot of what they've spent on players. But they're now, the more you're there, the more your players are valuable as well. So they're selling... that Kirke's going to Liverpool for £50 million, so you become this self-sustaining huge business, and it doesn't really matter if you've got 10,000 or 40,000 going every week, and it's really hard for Leeds to finish above that. And not to dig out Bournemouth specifically, but I worry that if that 17 gets sort of crystallised, which as a Villa fan I prefer that to being in the Championship, but I think that will be really bad for the kind of long-term health of the Premier League.
I agree, and I think it's one reason why audiences dropped away this season, and at the other end you had a runaway leader, I forget who the name were, this season. I often dig out Bournemouth, not because their hardcore is 4,500, and I actually have a great amount of respect for the way that they're run. I know a lot of people in there. But this idea that attendances and size of ground doesn't matter as much as it used to. You've basically seen clubs like Fleetwood get into League One with a tiny fan base and come up against your Sheffield Wednesdays, and these things really used to matter and don't now. And Bournemouth, you know, they just saw the play to Real Madrid last week. They've got that Premier League seal of approval. If a player does well for Bournemouth in eighth position in the Premier League, then he's good enough to play for anyone.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to what you were saying earlier about the Premier League just being so much stronger. And, you know, doing well for Bournemouth, who are eighth in the Premier League, is totally different for, I don't know who finished eighth in La Liga last season, but that's not as impressive around the world. The Premier League is so competitive. There are so many good players that if you do well in mid-table, you're probably one of the best players in the world, pretty much, or best 100 or 200.
And Manchester United in your book in any other way, or did they come across?
Several times. I saw Manchester United shirts in Colombia, in India, in Texas, in Qatar. I mean, I just noted down before we come on the United Spurs shirt sponsors over the years, which I think tell some interesting stories. I mean, the first one you've got. I mean, can you name them?
I'll have a go at it.
I've got all of them with the years written down here.
Right, so you're testing me now. Sharp Electronics.
Yeah, so I've got Sharp as one.
Okay,
category.
Sharp UCAM.
Do you want to guess the years?
So I would say 83 might be the first.
82.
82, all right, I'm having that. And then I'm going to start losing it in the noughties when it started going. Vodafone was a huge one.
Yeah, so that overtook from Sharp in
2000. Oh.
Sorry, yeah.
I remember a conversation about that with that happening in 2000 when Manchester United were actually world champions long time ago.
Yeah, so apart from that,
I'm going to start losing them now.
There's a company in Manchester called Classic Football Shirts. Sell. And I met the guy. I went there. It's in Hyde, just outside Manchester, big warehouse. And the guy, Doug Beaton, who runs that company, his favourite shirt ever, he's a United fan, is the Sharp with the little zipper, which of course was the treble shirt.
Okay, and then we're going to go, I remember, AON.
Correct. There's one between Vodafone and AON.
AIG.
Yeah.
There was a big one for Chevrolet, which when I saw the numbers of that, I thought, how on earth have they pulled that one off? I'm not sure that Chevrolet's shareholders were quite as infused about it as Manchester United's executives.
Well, that brings us on to our next one, which is an interesting story in itself. You remember this, the one before the current one?
Go on.
A Team Viewer, which was 21 to 24, which is a sort of German software company. But basically the board or the investors were outraged because there was, you know, it's something like 10% of their annual budget was going on Manchester United shirts. And it's a pretty, I think it's a sort of B2B, you know, business to business software. It's not something that you're selling in the high street. So these German guys were like, why are we doing that? You know, I'm sure it looks cool if you've got it, you know, that shirt up in your swanky office lobby in Frankfurt, but unclear it was a good use of the company money.
And then Snapdragon.
Yeah. Which is another interesting one, because that's also business to business. You know, if you buy a Samsung phone, for example, it'll have a Qualcomm Snapdragon chip in it, which most end users and consumers don't have a clue. You know, you've got your iPhone or your Samsung or whatever else. So it's clearly looking at sort of business to business marketing, which is interesting in itself. You know, they're probably appealing to like Chinese factory owners rather than a bloke in the street or wherever. But that story kind of tells you like how Manchester United has become a global brand. I mean, particularly with those big American finance companies, that's quite interesting to me. But Sharp, loads of English teams had Japanese electronics companies. So you had JVC and Arsenal for a very long time. The first
Hitachi,
Liverpool. That was the first top flight one. The first ever one was actually Kettering Tires. But the first top flight one was Hitachi. You had Panasonic at Nottingham Forest. You had Brother at Man City. Loads of them, and that was basically Japanese electronics companies selling kit to British households, right? If you want a new TV, you might think, oh, I'll get a Sharp, or printers or photocopiers. But even though it was a Japanese company, it was a very domestic thing. All that stuff has got so much cheaper now. Like a TV is your proportion of your annual. I bought one the other week for like £300, like massive, nice TV. I mean, as a proportion of the average income, that's really low compared to what it would have been in the 80s when you'd really save up for something like that. Vodafone, the story that tells is like, you know, Britain getting online, right? Mobile phone contracts. There's NTL sponsored Aston Villa, Newcastle. And that was a huge industry which didn't exist in the 90s, right? You know, we're now all spending a grand a year on phone and internet, which we didn't before. So imagine how much value was created for business in that. And then, yeah, you see from 2006, it really starts getting international, which ties into, you know, the Manchester United story of, you know, the Glazers and whatever else. I mean, I don't know the details, but I'm sure it's no coincidence that shortly after the Glazers came in, you get some big American companies. And then Chevrolet and as part of General Motors, a huge American car manufacturer. And you see that trend in a lot of other, you know, big club shirts, like Liverpool going from, I don't know how to wash my mouth out on talking about that on this pod, but going from Crown Paints, which is in Lancashire, to, you know, Standard Chartered, this massive global bank, which doesn't have any customers in the UK. So the story of many of these Premier League shirts is just becoming, you know, more and more global. Arsenal going to Emirates.
And how big an influence is the American market? Because my next Manchester United game will be in New Jersey next month. The club continually go to the United States. So before 2003, they've not been to America since the 70s. And they go because they get the match fees. You've got a consumer market which will stomach tickets for $150 on average, even to see Manchester United against Wrexham, Manchester United under-21s even. It was always said to me that the consumer market sophisticated, counterfeiting is not a huge deal there, as it might be in some parts of Asia. That's where the sponsors are. And then you've got these side positives, like the players like it. They can walk down Fifth Avenue, or used to be able to. I always remember Paul Scholes getting off the Man United bus and walking down Fifth Avenue in New York and just loving being anonymous. Probably going to change now, because that was 20 years ago. And then you see the number of owners of Premier League teams who are from America. The American influence is significant, isn't it?
Yeah, and I went to this book for this book. I mean, I've been to America a lot, but mainly to the sort of coast, places like New York and San Francisco, where there are quite a lot of football fans, because there are a lot of, you know, Europeans living there. There are a lot of Hispanics. It's quite sort of liberal. You know, they don't like Donald Trump. So I went to Texas, you know, barbecue and steak and Donald Trump and whatever else. Very different culture. They see football as a bit, you know, something for women and children, a bit European. But I think that's changing quite quickly. And I went to a game in Houston. I went to a game in Dallas. And certainly you're right about the market. You know, I think sometimes people think about the number of people, the population of a country. And obviously India or China, there's far more people. But in America, they're a lot richer. They're frankly a lot richer than they are in Europe now. I mean, in the last 15, 20 years, the UK has stagnated and America has got far richer. I was in New York. I couldn't believe how much more expensive it was than the previous time I've been. And that was because, you know, British salaries have stayed flat and American salaries have gone up loads. And people, I know, I think we also have a very different culture when it comes to sport. In the UK, football is massive on a club level, but no other sport is really. I mean, you know, we have rugby and cricket, but it's pretty minor. The people, if you live in Boston, you might support all the Boston teams, which will mean, oh, you might have to help me here off the top of my head. You've obviously got the Red Sox in baseball, you've got the New England Patriots, you've got hockey, and you've got
Celtics.
NBA, Celtics, yeah. Is it the Bruins in high school? And that's totally normal. You know, maybe a women's team in there as well, soccer team. That culture doesn't exist really anywhere else. So the idea of adding an extra team onto that, oh, Manchester United as well, is not that alien. Whereas if you say to your average Brit, you know, do you support the new, you know, do you support an NFL team? Some people do, but it's not really part of our culture. And then they love sport, and they're, I think, you know, sometimes easy as a Brit to be a bit disparaging of the Americans and they're saying soccer and whatever else, but they're much more sort of statistical about it, I think, than Europeans actually. I mean, maybe they don't have that deep culture of it like we do, and they're really into the sort of data and the transfers and all that sort of thing. I watched I was in New York a few months ago and I watched a Villa game. It's actually a terrible 4-1 defeat against Tottenham. And I went to the... I saw there's a New York supporters club. So I went there and it was in this sort of sports bar. And they were the real sort of football hipsters, the sort of real weirdos and misfits of the US soccer scene, the Villa fans. But it was quite fun, yeah.
A couple of things you've said there have sort of triggered me into things I've heard just in the last week. Josimar, the Norwegian investigative football magazine. Very good. It's very good. Cry for help. And I was reading why they need money. And one of the points they made is basically people in the global south have got no buying power to buy any of their work. And that's quite interesting. United We Stand, which does well as a printed magazine in 2025, doesn't have a single subscriber in Nigeria, where there's huge numbers of Manchester United fans. Manchester United have never played a single game in India, where the club is hugely popular. And keep going back to the US. Played in Nigeria once in 2009 on the way back from South Africa. And your point about the US, you know, we're picking up loads of readers and subscribers from the US. I get people coming up to me outside Old Trafford every single game now. It's, "Hi, Andy, I listen to this, I read that, I'm from Seattle," or wherever. And this is becoming quite normal now. And I don't think Manchester United fans always see this because they're not on the ground outside the stadium. So even in the way we consume media, I can see a huge demand. I mean, The Athletic, who I work for, is owned by the New York Times.
Yeah.
And then I can see different people consuming different types of media according to where they are in the world.
What do you mean? What different media do people...
So my example was for United We Stand, for example. We don't have a single subscriber in West Africa where there is a huge number of Manchester United fans, at least not to the printed edition. Maybe there's one or two who buy the... It was put to me that the purchasing power in some countries is just really low, which plays into what I said about Josimar the other day. Like, people love what we do, but they're not prepared to pay for it.
Yeah, I think America also has a real culture. You know, it's a very consumerist, very capitalist culture, and a real culture of, like, paying for stuff, just buying things. You know, if you go to a sports match in America, people are just, they're wearing the shirt, they've got the cap, they've got a huge hot dog. They've got, you know, people just, you know, think nothing of spending 100 quid on stuff, which is easier when you've got more money and more purchasing power. And I think a really kind of consumeristic culture. It's a kind of paradox. You know, it's a funny thing. Football's becoming more global, bigger around the world. The Premier League is watched in 200 countries, whatever. But actually, the scope is potentially narrowing of who they're targeting because they just want the people with the most money. And they're, you know, not necessarily in the UK anymore. I mean, the UK is skint and has been for almost 20 years. Like, there's not much people with spare cash in the UK anymore. The America is booming. And, you know, I think we sometimes look at America through the lens of politics and chaos, and there is a lot of that. But if you just look at the economy through different presidents, it's booming and has been for as long as we've been alive.
I used to go to America and it was cheap. You'd go with an empty suitcase, you'd fill it up. And I remember 2006, it was... $2 equals one, 2-1. And then I went in October 22, the week that Liz Truss crashed the economy. And I was in Chicago and it was like, I'm just going to ring my bank manager to see if it's okay to buy a coffee.
Yeah.
We're talking about America with Manchester United. There's this huge cloud, which is the Glazers and their ownership of Manchester United, which has existed for over 20 years now. That has not been good for Manchester United. Do you see any redeeming features of their ownership, being relatively neutral and as an outsider yourself, and fact that as a
active opponent, then it's good because it's suppressed the biggest club in the, you know, it's made the best club in the league a lot worse. You know, we could have been in a Paris Saint-Germain or Bayern Munich type league where one club, you know, Manchester United was certainly in a position to become that. I suppose the thing that actually changed that was Roman Abramovich and Abu Dhabi. Do I see any redeeming feature in the Glazers? £3 beers? No, and I think the real original sin, you know, the biggest sin of it all is actively taking money out of the club, you know, loading the club with debt and whatever else. I mean, people complain about Daniel Levy at Tottenham for not putting his hand in his pocket, but he's not taking money out as a sort of for his own financial purposes and saddling the club with debt. It's a pretty unique, and I'm sure you'll know other examples, but I think it's a pretty unique ownership system, Manchester United's, and I think it should have never been allowed. And I know you were involved. There's a campaign, wasn't there, in the 2000s to block it, because, you know, and I think football clubs are different from any other business. And I think, you know, there's a lot of talk now about, you know, regulators and whatever else. I don't really want to get into that, but I think, you know, football club isn't just like your local Tesco. You know, if it does get taken over and run into the ground, that is different, because it means, you know, certainly Aston Villa means an incredible amount to me, and Manchester United to you, and these things are part of families and communities and friendship groups, and they should be on a slightly different, you know, legal playing field to any other business.
And finally, and I would recommend anyone read your book, because it's fascinating and you're a great talker when you're telling us about it. Is a regulator a good thing for football?
I'm becoming more sceptical of it, if I'm honest. I don't quite understand what problem it's trying to solve. I think there's a lot that's going. There's a lot that's good about the Premier League at the moment, which is easily obscured. I mean, people vote with their feet, right? Stadiums are full every week. I don't think people understand how big a deal that is. That's not happening anywhere else apart from Germany. The lower reaches of the game, where I think 10 years ago people said, you know, the Premier League's great, the best players want to play here, but it's killing football down the pyramid. I think the opposite has happened. And I think for a very good reason, which you'll know going to Manchester United, I'll know seeing Aston Villa. It's great. But I went with a mate to Stockport the other week, and it was really fun in a totally different way. It was full of 16-year-old lads singing all game, standing with their mates. Cost 10 quid to get in. It's a different product, and it's, you know, the football's worse, of course it is. And if you go lower down the pyramid, non-league, you know, people like walking to the end of their road and chatting to their neighbour. And I think the Premier League has kind of risen the popularity of football generally. So I think it's hugely flawed, and I think there are regulations that need bringing in, but I'm pretty sceptical of this new powerful regulator having sort of unintended consequences. And I think it needs to be really clear about what problems it's trying to fix. I think one very specific problem which we've spoken about is the bottom of the Premier League. And I think you could maybe tweak the PSR rules for promoted teams is maybe something I would look at. You know, allow Leeds or Burnley to spend a bit more money. Otherwise, they're just going to go straight back down. But I think the changes that are needed are tweaks. I mean, I think the big problem is state, the huge problem is state ownership, and this thing is not going to have the teeth to kick out the Saudis and Abu Dhabi. I mean, it's very hard now because obviously we've got the City and the charges rolling on, but that is the, you know, as soon as you allowed the doors to state ownership, that was a big problem. But the regulator's clearly not going to touch that because it's a complete live wire.
Joe, I'd like to thank you for your time. More Than a Shirt, published by Orion. How Football Shirts Explain Global Politics, Money and Power by Joe Adurso. With a nice red cover there for your red cartel leadership. That. Joking. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Joey.
Thank you very much.